Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When today's guest, Dr. Robert Lustig, was on our show back in November, we couldn't keep up with the phone calls and the emails coming in, so we decided to invite him back. Dr. Lustig is author of the book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. He argues that over the past 50 years, Americans have become more sick, unhappy, and broken. He writes, What we think we want, what we're told will bring us happiness, is just a clever marketing scheme to lead us to consume more and more. Wall Street, Madison Avenue, Las Vegas, Silicon Valley, and Washington, D.C. have gotten inside our heads, exploiting newly discovered brain physiology and chemistry to confuse and conflate pleasure with happiness. Our behaviors are not our own because our minds have been hacked. So what can we do about profit-seeking industries that have pushed addictive substances into our lives and absolved themselves of the consequences? Dr. Robert Lustig is professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and a member of the Institute for Health Policy Studies at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also chief science officer of Eat Real, a nonprofit dedicated to reversing childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. His latest book is The Hacking of the American Mind. And Dr. Lustig joins me in studio. Hi. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me, Rose. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's great to have you. We had you on last year, and we wanted to bring you back because, I mean, the headlines are just so depressing. When you look at the opioid addiction numbers, they're just increasing by the month.
Indeed. It's not just opioids. There are all sorts of addictions that are increasing. And the most prominent and the most worrisome and the one that I think is the biggest existential crisis is technology addiction. And I'm sure we'll get into that. You know, what happened with Cambridge Analytica and what role that played in where we are today. There's a science behind this, and I'm happy to explore it with you.
A science behind this, and the main argument in your book is that a variety of corporations and marketing schemes from Madison Avenue to Washington, D.C., are exploiting a newly discovered brain physiology and chemistry to confuse and conflate pleasure with happiness.
Right. So, well, let's start with some definitions.
Yes.
Okay. Pleasure and happiness, a lot of people think they're the same thing. They're not. They never were, but we've been led to believe they are because people say, oh, you're unhappy. You need this to get happy. Well, basically, those are pleasures. So what are the differences between pleasure and happiness? And in the book, I describe seven. Pleasure is short-term. Happiness is long-term. Pleasure is visceral. You feel it in your body. Happiness is ethereal. You feel it above the neck. Pleasure is taking. Happiness is giving. Pleasure is experienced alone. Happiness is usually experienced in social groups. Pleasure can be achieved with substances. Happiness cannot be achieved with substances. The extremes of pleasure, whether it be substances or behaviors, substances like cocaine, alcohol, nicotine, heroin, sugar, and behaviors, shopping, gambling, social media, internet, gaming, porn. In the extreme, all lead to addiction. There's an aholic after each one of those, whereas there's no such thing as being addicted to too much happiness. Mm. And finally, number seven, the one that the book is really about, pleasure is dopamine, happiness is serotonin. So two different biochemicals, two different areas of the brain, two different modes of action, two different sets of receptors. So like, why do we care? Who cares? You know, I want it now. Mm. Well, that's part of the reason, is because you want it now. Everyone wants it now because that's what pleasure does. Here's the problem. Dopamine, this neurotransmitter in our brain, it is the primary driver of reward. It is the primary driver of learning. It is important. It is the reason you get out of bed in the morning. No dopamine, you might as well just put a bullet right through your forehead. Okay? It's and you know, animal models demonstrate that this is an extraordinarily important pathway for survival. Here's the problem. Dopamine is an excitatory neurotransmitter. It excites the second neuron. When it's released, it goes to across the synapse, which is the little cleft between two neurons, binds to receptors on the second neuron, and then activates it and causes it to fire. Now, neurons like to fire. Neurons like to be stimulated. That's why they have receptors. But neurons like to be tickled, not bludgeoned. Chronic overstimulation of any neuron anywhere in the brain will lead to neuronal cell death. And we know that from all the kids with chronic seizure disorders, the kids we take care of at UCSF in the intensive care unit trying to stop their seizures. Okay, and we see what happens afterwards. So in order to protect themselves, dopamine receptor containing neurons have a failsafe. It has a option B. It has a self-defense mechanism. What it does is it downregulates the number of dopamine receptors. It gets rid of extra receptors, which makes it harder for any given dopamine molecule to find a receptor. This is called the law of mass action. So what does it mean in human terms? You get a hit, you get a rush. Receptors go down. Next time you need a bigger hit to get the same rush because the receptors went down. And then a bigger hit, bigger hit, bigger hit until finally a huge hit to get nothing. That's called tolerance. And then when the neurons actually start to die, that's called addiction. Now, the question is, why do teenagers manifest addictions more than adults? And the answer is because the area of their brain in the front called the prefrontal cortex, the executive function area, the area that keeps you from doing stupid things, it's the last area of the brain to develop. It is the last area of the brain to myelinate. Myelin is the fatty sheath around neurons so that they basically don't fry. It is the last thing to get myelinated is this area here. So imagine a copper wire that is bare versus a copper wire that is insulated with, you know, plastic coating. Mm-hmm. Which one's more likely to burn out?
The bare one.
The bare one, right, exactly. Same thing in the brain. So unmyelinated neurons are 8 times more likely to die with any given stimulus than a myelinated neuron. Well, adolescents have boatloads of unmyelinated neurons sitting right up there behind their forehead, and they are getting pelted with addictive substances, especially sugar, but, you know, working your way up to cocaine, heroin, fentanyl, etc., and also behaviors like internet gaming, social media, pornography. This is not good for a brain. Mm. And we are seeing now the outcome, the aftermath, the ultimate decay in our adolescent population today because of this inability to distinguish pleasure from happiness and thinking that pleasure is happiness because we were told so.
What strikes you the most about the young patients you see? And, I mean, we all see this when we go out at a restaurant, for example. The kids are on their phone the whole time. Kids as young as 2, 3
yes.
have iPads.
Right. So in my clinic, the parent would often bring the entire family because, you know, they don't have babysitters for everybody. So the kid would come. And then, of course, the younger kids being wheeled in the stroller. And, of course, the mother had to shut the kid up in order to be able to function and talk. So she'd hand the kid an iPad, a 15-month-old working an iPad. This is not exactly smart. But this is, you know, we made the TV the babysitter. Now the iPad's the babysitter. The bottom line is, childhood is about growth. Childhood is about being alone with your thoughts. Childhood is about imagination. Childhood is about realizing who you are. And the problem is that technology, being ever present, ever available, has actually kept children from doing their work, which is imagination, living with boredom, living with their thoughts, living with the idea that they are individuals not connected to some machine. Mm. Kids don't know what being alone is anymore. Sherry Turkle, the famous media researcher at MIT, coined the term alone together for social media. That's exactly right.
What will this do to children as they age? So if you're given an iPad at 15 months, how does that affect your development? Well, and what are the main differences between TV and the iPad?
Okay. We don't know the answer to that question yet because we haven't had the opportunity to watch people longitudinally over time. We know what short-term effects there are, and we know that it alters fMRI patterns in the brain, but these are relatively short-term studies. So it's very difficult to say what will happen long-term. We do know that some pathways in the brain are genetically determined, but we also know that experience determines how synapses form. So if you're altering the early childhood experience, will this have sort of implications down the road? The best I can do today is not with technology, but with adverse childhood experiences. This is the thing that's been looked at most carefully. So ACEs, something Nadine Bercaris here in San Francisco is one of the world's experts on. Child abuse or sexual abuse at very young ages has effects on the developing brain, basically a post-traumatic stress disorder type effect, where it causes the amygdala, the area of the brain that's the fear center, to overgrow, the hippocampus, which is the memory part, to shrink. Mm-hmm. And so basically you become use a vernacular, a bucket of nerves. Mm-hmm. There's virtually no ability to tamp down on anxiety, fear, et cetera. This happens in animal models of addiction, and this appears to happen in short-term studies of children and adolescents as well. And we are seeing those structural changes in people who are, say, internet addicts. This was work done in, for instance, South Korea. The question is, we didn't have the MRIs before they started being internet addicts. So we only have correlation, not causation, in humans. We haven't done the longitudinal studies going forward in time to be able to say, yes, this was the causative thing. Or is it maybe that people with, bad amygdalas, are the ones who gravitate toward these addictions in the first place? That we don't know yet.
Hmm. Dr. Robert Lustig is author of The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. We were talking about children, and I wanted to ask you a more general question about where we are right now, because since you were on in November, the opioid addiction numbers have gotten even worse. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how our economic situation, specifically massive inequality, contributes to all of this. There is a piece recently in the Huffington Post, Why the U.S., One of the World's Richest Countries, Struggles with Diseases of Poverty. 12 million Americans have a disease linked to extreme poverty. Indeed. And then that study about how if you had an emergency that would cost $1,000, the majority of Americans, about 63%, said they couldn't come up with the money.
So we have a huge inequity crisis in this country. We used to have something called the upper class, the middle class, and the lower class. The middle class has basically either shifted up or shifted down. There's virtually nobody left in the middle. And there are very specific Supreme Court decisions and, congressional policies that have led to this, really stemming from the notion that businesses had to sort of take over America back in the late 1970s. This was actually the calling card of one associate justice of the Supreme Court I talk about in the book, Lewis F. Powell Jr., said that, he was worried about what happened in the 60s where, there was fomenting unrest, and he basically said corporations need to take back America. There have been numerous political philosophers that have opined on this issue ever since. Michael Gillens from Princeton, Sheldon Wolin also wrote a book called Democracy Incorporated, where he envisioned the day when Washington and Wall Street would be one and the same. Guess what? We're there. Mm. We have reached it with Donald Trump as our CEO. No question. The question, what does it mean and what happens? There is a group at Harvard called the Equality of Opportunity Project, and it's led by a brilliant economist by the name of Raj Chetty. And they have done some really, really interesting work looking at where you were born as to what your life experience will be, having nothing to do with your education, with your economy, with, you know, virtually anything that we, or your obesity, anything else that would be potential confounders. They've been able to factor these things out. And it turns out that where you were born, just, you know, what county you were born in, what zip code you were born in, has enormous implications for what happens to you all throughout life. These have become prisons of our own making. If you are born in Baltimore, you are screwed. It's that simple. You will make 25% less than your parents will, just because you were born in Baltimore, having nothing to do with whether you went to school in Baltimore. I mean, you could have gone to Hopkins, you could have gone to Maryland, you could have gone, you know, to Goucher College, you could have gone virtually anywhere, but it wouldn't matter. You will make 25% less than your parents just because you were born in Baltimore. And of course, there are counties where it's the opposite. You'll make more. The bottom line is this concept of equality that we, you know, based this country on has virtually disappeared over the last 40 to 50 years, in part because we have given business the run of the roost. There has been virtually a spate of Supreme Court decisions that have given the ability to run Americans' lives to business. Examples of this are Buckley v. Valeo, that allowed basically businesses to provide campaign funding at any level they want. And most recently, of course, is Citizens United, where corporations became people. So people who work for corporations have double protection. They have the protection of being a citizen. They also have the protection of being an employee of a corporation. There's no way today that an employee of a corporation can go to jail, and they never do. Mm. So there's no impetus for them to do otherwise.
You mentioned Baltimore, which is, according to the latest stats, about 63% black. Mm-hmm. And you reminded me of a piece in the New York Times that got a lot of attention in March. And this data comes from researchers at Harvard and Stanford. Black boys raised in this country, even in the wealthiest families and living in some of the most well-to-do neighborhoods, still earn less in adulthood than white boys with similar backgrounds. White boys who grew up rich are likely to remain that way. Black boys raised at the top are more likely to become poor than to stay wealthy in their own adult households.
Exactly. And that's Raj Chetty's work, too.
Okay.
I'm very familiar. I mean, they looked at many different things in this Equality of Opportunity Project. One of course, was race. And yes, race continues to play an enormous differentiating role in our society. And you can sort of see how it's all played out, you know, in the last 2 years. This is an existential crisis for America. I think it's very clear to most people, especially on the coasts, that there are two Americas right now. You know, there are the coasts and there's everything in between. I don't have the prescription for what, you know, to do about this. You know, I am not a politician or a sociologist. But what I can say is that here in the Bay Area and along the coast, we have at least a little bit more of a semblance of what the difference between pleasure and happiness is, because we can experience both of them in our daily lives. In the middle of the country, it's way harder. And they have, I mean, if you look, for instance, where the opioid crisis is, it's there. It's not here.
I was just reading in the Chronicle about how in Kentfield, they're now gathering data because there are a lot more people who are dying from an opioid crisis.
There,
I mean, this is in Marin County.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is a problem, but I mean,
it's definitely not.
Ohio is ground zero, and if you go out from Ohio, it goes, you know, from there. I'm not saying it's not, you know, I'm not saying it's not everywhere,
right?
But it's particularly egregious in the middle of the country.
Dr. Robert Lustig is author of the book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Our Brains. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a question or comment for Dr. Lustig, There's so much here. We're talking about addiction to many things, addiction to sugar. And then you add that to inequality, and then you add race to that. And there's just so many layers. And, you know, the question is, how do we truly tackle this? You need federal changes, federal programs, federal funding. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org.
So, Rose, you could make the argument, and I actually do make the argument, that government needs to be involved. On the other hand, part of the reason why this has happened is because of the government. You know, it depends on what the policy is. For instance, let's just take sugar for a minute, because I know that the best. You know,
right.
the opioid thing is a little bit more complicated, and you know, and I will put that to the side for a second. But let's just talk about the sugar issue. Okay, in 1933, we had the first Farm Bill, and the Farm Bill came about because of two phenomena that were occurring simultaneously: the Depression and the Dust Bowl. So we had a destitute population in the West and Southwest, and all of the food-making machinery, et cetera, were all in the Northeast. The problem was, you can't get the food onto the railroad cars and ship it across country and expect it not to go rancid in the process. It just takes that long. So what they did was they started processing it. So they started taking off the fiber, the kernel, the wheat germ of the wheats, to put them into 5-pound bags of white flour, you know, and bags of sugar to do the same. And then they shipped those across, and those stayed. And then you bake it up, for instance, you know, locally. And we saved a destitute population back in the Depression. And, you know, this policy that we subsidized these crops, commodity crops, corn, wheat, soy, sugar, made sense all the way through World War II. But then it stopped making sense because the Dust Bowl was over, the Depression was over. But we didn't stop that policy. In fact, we doubled down. People figured out, oh, we can make money doing this. Mm. Okay, and so we doubled down, and we actually poured more money into it. And at this point in time, the Farm Bill is, you know, somewhere on the order of about $192 billion. It is a major piece of the, economy of this country, and it provides increased weight to commodity crop producing states. So I always say, what's the dirtiest 4-letter word in the English language? Iowa.
Mm.
Okay, it's all corn. Okay, it's all corn. Yeah, there used to be cows there, but they took the cows and put them in Kansas. All right, so that, because we doubled down, because we said we will provide subsidies for these crops, it actually made sense to do monoculture. So we have all the corn in Iowa, but the problem is there's no manure in Iowa because all the cattle are in Kansas. So we have to spray the corn with petrochemicals, okay, which causes runoff and causes pollution. And in Kansas, we have all the cows in feedlots. Okay, they're not chewing the grass. They're not getting the micronutrients they need, so they get sick, so we have to pump them full of antibiotics. In addition, they're eating the corn that was made in Iowa that goes down, and the problem is corn-fed beef becomes very fatty very fast. And I can show you some slides of what Italian beef or Argentinian beef look like versus U.S. beef. Mm. And basically, that animal has metabolic syndrome because it normally takes 18 months to go from birth to slaughter if you're eating grass, if a cow eats grass. But it only takes 6 months if a cow eats corn. So it's cash flow. So from a make food cheap standpoint, all of these things made sense. From a health, welfare, and ultimately societal standpoint, this is a friggin' disaster. And it's a disaster that the American government foisted upon us. Mm. How are you going to fix that?
I'll ask you that after the break. I'll also ask you what happens when you eat that corn-fed meat or these sugary treats that are everywhere in our society now. Today we're joined by Dr. Robert Lustig, author of The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Dr. Robert Lustig. His latest book is The Hacking of the American Mind, the science behind the corporate takeover of our bodies and brains. Dr. Lustig is a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also chief science officer of Eat Real, a nonprofit dedicated to reversing childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You can also watch on Facebook, KALW Public Radio, click on the video, and then leave a comment. Before the break, Dr. Lustig, you were talking about...
By the way, it's Robert.
This enormous farm bill and all of these different interests and the complexity of now the animal agriculture system. How do you begin to untangle this mess?
Well, okay, this is an enormous problem. I mean, this is like, you know, trying to solve the Middle East conflict in terms of the stakeholders. Everyone's got a different view of this. So this is not something that can be easily unwound. However, I personally think that the most rational way to deal with this problem and the way that we could actually get the most people on board would be to do away with food subsidies. Mm. Now, people say, well, if you do away with food subsidies, food will get expensive. Not so. Turns out the Giannini Foundation over at UC Berkeley modeled what food would look like in terms of what would go up, what would go down, what would change price, what wouldn't, if we got rid of all food subsidies. I mean, it has to be across the board all. And it turns out that the price of food wouldn't really change very much except for two items. Corn and sugar, they would go up. And that is exactly what we want. Mm. Now, Iowa won't be happy, but, you know, virtually everybody else will. I mean, ultimately, no matter what you will do to try to solve this problem, there will be winners and losers. I think there are several things that could be done to try to mitigate some of the effects. For instance, at UCSF, we have done something. We have the Healthy Beverage Initiative. If you come on campus, you can't find a soft drink. Hmm. You can't find a drink with sugar in it because we are trying to model for the public what good behavior is. Where was smoking first banned? In hospitals. Okay, we're supposed to basically tell people what it is they're supposed to be doing. The problem is that today, 28% of children's hospitals have a fast food restaurant in the lobby. That's kind of a problem.
Right.
Okay. Second thing I would do, let's rename type 2 diabetes. No one knows what it means anyway. The word diabetes is Egyptian. It's not Latin, so it's, you know, we don't really understand it. Diabetes means siphon, because you're in the bathroom peeing your brains out. Mm. Okay. Let's call it what it really is. Processed food disease. Now, that's a teaching moment. You go to the doctor and the doctor says, oh, you have processed food disease. That means a whole lot more than type 2 diabetes does, doesn't it? Okay. So I think there are things we could do. I think rolling back subsidies on commodity crops would be a great thing to do. Our nonprofit is praising the good, Eat Real. We certify restaurants, cafeterias, schools, hospitals that serve real food. So if you see a green fork in the window, you know, if you eat here, it won't kill you. You know, that is, you know, then putting pressure on competitors to have to match. And, you know, this has been very successful here in the Bay Area. And also we have a outpost in Tennessee where we've been able to certify 50 restaurants as serving real food. Mm-hmm. And the Tennessee Department of Health actually is paying for this because this is good for their public to be able to understand the difference. And most importantly for me, my sort of raison d'etre, my sort of cause célèbre, my windmill, if you will, is getting sugar off the FDA's generally recognized as safe list because it's not safe. You know, one lump or two, you know, as we used to say, that was about the sugar you got in a day. Today, it's, you know, 19 lumps or 20, and that is the problem. There is an upper limit to how much sugar your liver can metabolize before it gets sick. And that number is about 6 teaspoons of added sugar per day. But the American public is consuming 19 and a half teaspoons of added sugar per day on average. So triple our upper limit. So we are getting sick because of it. These diseases, fatty liver disease, type 2 diabetes, these were the diseases of aging before. These were the diseases of alcohol before. But today, children get both of these diseases. They never got it before. And the reason is because sugar and alcohol are metabolized the same way. But sugar's legal and alcohol is not legal for children. Basically, sugar is the alcohol of the child. And we should be treating it as such. Mm-hmm. We should be limiting exposure. Breakfast is dessert in America. That's a problem. Mm.
Let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. Dr. Lustig, I've read a couple of your books, and I guess on a macro level, I agree with you. Something needs to be done nationwide. I'm concerned. I just made a visit to the emergency room, unfortunately, and I'm watching people, the snacks that are available over there in the emergency room. My guess is that this is a big problem now, but I think in the next 5 or 10 years there's going to be an explosion unless something changes with people suffering all kinds of diseases, diabetes, you know, whatever you want, from this kind of thing. So I applaud your work, but I want to ask you something on more of a micro level.
Mm-hmm.
I read your book, Fat Chance, and am into the hacking of the American mind. But I'm wondering, there is so much, well, I couldn't say disagreement. There are other people who have written on this subject, too. David Perlmutter, a guy by the name of Emron something. I can't remember his name.
Emron Meyer?
Yes, right, exactly.
From UCLA, yep.
Exactly. The problem is that everybody has got a little bit of different take. I mean, there's some consensus. I mean, sugar certainly is a problem. They see that, carbohydrates, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if somebody was trying to look, I mean, I don't know who's the most authoritative. That's the point. I'm trying to think if somebody was interested in this from their own perspective or trying to change people's approach to eating, is there some, do you have a source other than your own work that you think is credible?
Totally. There are a lot of people who are saying the same thing. Ultimately, Emron Meyer and David Perlmutter are railing against refined carbohydrate. I am too. Refined carbohydrate is problematic, and the reason is because refined carbohydrate gets digested, absorbed in the duodenum, in the first part of the intestine, before the bacteria in your intestine have a chance to chew it up. What I have learned, and what we as a medical community have learned, is that if you don't have fiber in the diet, that would be refined carbohydrate. That's what you take out, is the fiber. If you don't have fiber in the diet, that fiber is the food for your bacteria. So when you're eating real food, you're eating for two. You're eating for yourself and you're eating for your bacteria in your gut. Mm-hmm. You have 10 trillion cells in your body. Your gut has 100 trillion bacteria in your intestine. They outnumber you 10 to 1. You are just a big bag of bacteria with legs. Now, you got to feed them. Okay? And if you don't feed them, what's going to happen to them? Turns out, if you don't feed them, the bacteria are so smart that they consume the mucin layer, the mucus layer on top of the intestinal epithelial cells and on top of the colonic epithelial cells, and they will then chew that up for their energy, thus exposing your intestine to all of those bacteria, making the possibility of leaky gut, autoimmune disease, metabolic syndrome, inflammation, just that more likely. So every single person who gets it, Darius Mozafarian, David Ludwig, Walt Willett, Emron Meyer, myself, and hosts of other people are all saying the same thing. Get rid of the refined carbohydrate and the sugar. And if you do that and add the fiber, and if you do that, you know what that's called? That's called real food. That's what I'm for. I'm for real food. And you know what? There isn't one dietitian, scientist, clinician, or anybody else who says that real food's a problem.
Hmm. Can you give us some examples of refined carbs?
Sure. Bread, rice, pasta, potatoes. White food. Okay? When wheat comes out of the ground, what color is it? It's brown. But when we turn it into bread, it's white. Where'd the brown go? got milled off at the mill. Now, the reason it got milled off at the mill is because the husk, that's the fiber, you know, that coats the entire kernel, the starch is in the center, the husk is on the outside, and also the germ, the wheat germ. And that's where the nucleic acids are. That's where the antioxidants are. When people are talking about eating your whole grains, basically what they're saying is eat the fiber-containing capsule because it takes a long time for your intestine to strip away that fiber. Therefore, when you consume it, your food with the inherent fiber that it comes with, that starch will come out later and slower, and that gives your bacteria a chance to utilize it. Plus, they'll consume the fiber. Plus, you have the nucleic acids for nutrition for them and for you. The point is that if you consume it right out of a white bag that says gold medal flour, okay, then that has been removed. Then you're going to absorb all that in your duodenum before it gets to your bacteria. You're going to overwhelm your liver's capacity to metabolize it. You're going to drive fatty liver disease, triglyceride formation, de novo lipogenesis, insulin resistance, chronic metabolic disease, all those diseases that we're talking about. That's the difference. So if you eat real food, you're keeping your liver safe and you're feeding your bacteria, both of which are absolutely essential for metabolic health.
And you've done studies on these issues.
I have.
Especially with children.
Especially with children.
What changes have you seen?
So we did a study that's gotten kind of a lot of press now. We took 43 kids out of our obesity clinic, Latino and African American, so low SES, so socioeconomic status, all big processed food consumers, all of whom had not just obesity, but at least one chronic metabolic disease. So they had metabolic syndrome. And what we did was we figured out what they were eating at home on a normal basis. We studied them on their home diet. And then for the next 9 days, we catered their meals, breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks. No added sugar. No added sugar. So when you take the added sugar out of a kid's diet, their percent of calories of sugar went from 28% to 10%. The amount of fructose, the bad molecule in sugar, went from 12% of calories to 4%. We gave them fruit, but no added sugar in any other fashion. Now, if you do that, you're going to take 350 to 400 calories out of a kid's diet, in which case they're going to be in negative energy balance, in which case they might lose weight, in which case if they got better, people would say, well, of course they got better, they lost weight. Duh. So we didn't want them to lose weight. So we had to give them back the 350 to 400 calories that we were taking out, but we had to give it as something else, not sugar. We gave them starch, refined starch, so fiberless starch. So in the vernacular, we took the pastries out, we put the bagels in. We took the sweetened yogurt out, we put the baked potato chips in. We took the chicken teriyaki out, we put the turkey hot dogs in. So we didn't give them good food, we gave them crappy food. We gave them processed food, we gave them Safeway food, okay? Mm-hmm. Processed food, but food kids would eat. But it was no added sugar food. It was chosen to be no added sugar. And we gave them a scale, and every day they'd stand on the scale. We'd say, what'd you weigh? And if it turned out that they were losing weight, eat more in order to keep their weight stable over the course of the 10 days. And then we studied them 10 days later on this diet that had the same amount of fat, the same amount of protein, the same amount of fiber, and the same amount of total carbohydrate, except instead of sugar, it was starch. Mm. Every aspect of their metabolic health improved.
Wow.
Everything.
10 days.
10 days.
Amazing.
Their metabolic syndrome basically reversed. Completely, totally, blood pressure down, triglycerides down. They had a lactate level. They're not supposed to. They did. It went away. Their fatty liver went down by 22% in just 10 days, whereas their subcutaneous fat didn't change because we didn't let them lose weight. Mm. So we know what metabolic syndrome is, and we know how to treat it. The problem is that our processed food environment today is causing it. Mm. We can reverse it, but we have to change the food.
And what you're talking about brings up so many issues around food justice. And have you checked in with these families? Because a lot of people here in the wealthy Bay Area don't have access to
That's
fruits
right.
and vegetables.
We got that. So it was very interesting. Something that we did not expect to happen, and so we didn't build it into the study, and we're really sorry now we didn't. The parents would tell us, you know, for the first 5 days of this new diet, the kids were really, really squirrely, irritable, not happy. But then the fever broke, if you will, mm-hmm. and they started feeling better. They started having more energy. They started concentrating better at school. They started exercising spontaneously. The teachers noticed it. The parents noticed it. We think we basically undid their sugar addiction. Mm-hmm. We think that we fixed the way their brains worked because we got rid of the added sugar. Now, can't prove it. It was all anecdotal. However, a lot of people have told me this, and you know, there's reason, there's a plausibility argument to be made as to how sugar works in the brain, why this would happen. We know that sugar is associated with dementia. We know that sugar causes insulin resistance, and insulin resistance causes dementia. We haven't yet shown that sugar causes dementia, but people are working on that. We definitely have data that shows that sugar consumption is associated with dementia. Could this be why kids are doing less well in school today? Can't answer that. But our anecdotal experience from this study would argue that this requires further research.
And just briefly, and we'll go back to calls, what advice would you give people who want to give up sugar? I recently did it. I'm about 2.5 months sugar-free. The first 10 days were so hard.
Yep.
And I'm pretty disciplined. They were brutal, in fact. Right. So what advice would you give people?
So the bottom line is, you know, people always said, and you know, we've had this statement in our, you know, our country for a long time, oh, you know, I have a horrendous sweet tooth. That's sugar addiction. Okay? Now, people say, well, how can you be addicted to sugar? There's no withdrawal. Well, the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, in 2013 changed the definition of addiction. It used to be tolerance and withdrawal. And withdrawal is the systemic effects of these various substances that we ingest and get addicted to. Cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, they all have an abstinence syndrome, a withdrawal syndrome. Mm-hmm. But those withdrawal symptoms are because of the way those compounds work on the body. Sugar is metabolized in the liver, and of course there's this effect on the brain. So it doesn't have a withdrawal syndrome. So people say, well, how can it be addictive then? Well, they say the same thing about gambling. You know, gambling's not a substance. Gambling doesn't have a withdrawal syndrome. But the American Psychiatric Association, through the fMRI data, through the PET scanning data, through the empiric data, and through the treatment data, decided, yes, gambling is addictive. It is a behavior, but it is addictive. And so in 2013, the DSM-5, the most recent compilation of addiction, says that behaviors are addictive. So they had a change from tolerance and withdrawal to tolerance and dependence. Mm. And there are 9 criteria for what dependence means. And if you read them, every obese person has them. Every tech-addicted person has them, too. Mm. So the American Psychiatric Association hasn't called tech addiction yet. They said internet gaming addiction is worthy of further study. They also said food addiction is worthy of further study, but they haven't said, yes, it is an addiction. However, we have the data to show that the same phenomenon in the brain is going on, the same fMRI, the same PET scanning, the same empiric data, and the same treatment data. Bottom line, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and it, you know, walks like a duck, it's a duck. And this is sugar addiction. This is technology addiction. Basically, anything that drives dopamine has addiction as its endpoint. Sugar drives dopamine. Mm-hmm. Technology drives dopamine.
Well, thank you for calling, Greg, and we hope you feel better soon. We've got an email from Myra who says, was it the government that imposed this backward food system on us or capitalism? Can you talk about the economic forces driving this problem? And we have about 3 minutes
sure.
left.
The answer is it started out the government, and then the capitalists moved in. We needed a method for subsidizing food back, you know, during the Depression. Now it's being driven purely by corporations. They do not want the Farm Bill to be changed. And every time the Farm Bill comes up for renewal every 5 years, there's a huge hoopla around it, and they haven't changed it yet. The scientists have demonstrated why this is a problem, and it's a problem on so many different levels. It's a problem in terms of land use. It's a problem in terms of the antibiotic use. It's a problem in terms of the petrochemical use. It's a problem in terms of climate change. It's a problem in terms of metabolic health and disease. It's a problem in terms of economic productivity. It's a problem every which way. But the stakeholders won't have it because they're afraid. They're afraid. You know, they know something has to give, but they're going to ride this bus till the wheels fall off. And that's what we're doing. Mm.
How should we, citizens who are concerned about these issues, tackle this?
Well, number one, you have to know what the problem is. You can't fix a problem if you don't understand it. And I hope people will read the book so that they understand what the problem is so that we can address it. In addition, this has to come from the voters, but they have to make this a priority. And right now, you know, obesity is still, quote, personal responsibility in most people's minds. You ate too much, you exercised too little. That's not what the science says at all. The science shows that a toxic food environment has altered our biochemistry, and the behavior is a manifestation of that altered biochemistry. And when you fix the environment, you fix the biochemistry, and therefore you fix the behavior. People should want our environment changed. They certainly want clean water. They certainly want clean air. They certainly want climate change to be, affected. Well, this is an aspect of climate change. Think of it this way. Agriculture is 20% of investment, but it is 40% of climate change. Agriculture, therefore food, plays an outsized role in our national discourse. Food has to rise to the top as being an issue, because when we solve the food, we will solve many of our current American dilemmas. Hmm.
Dr. Robert Lustig is author of The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. He's professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco. Robert, we'd love to have you back. Thank you so much for all your work, and thank you for joining us.
It would be my pleasure, Rose. Thank you, and thank the audience for very good questions, very appropriate.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.